This is Philosophy Bites with me, Nigel Warburton.
And me, David Edmonds.
Philosophy Bites is unfunded. Please help us keep it going by subscribing or donating at www.philosophybites.com, or you can become a patron at Patreon.
Ever since Marcel Duchamp exhibited a urinal signed R. Mutt in an open art exhibition in 1917, questions have been raised about what art is. His so-called ready-mades were decidedly cool conceptual pieces, devoid of emotional content. Since then, the idea that art has a link with emotion seems to have gone out of fashion. But it's an idea that Jesse Prince, of City University New York's Graduate Center, wants to resurrect.
Jesse Prince, welcome to Philosophy Bites.
It's wonderful to be here.
The topic we're going to focus on is art and emotion. Historically, in the 20th century, going into the 21st century, emotions have been downplayed in the philosophy of art. There's a sense in which we've moved away from saying that art is all about emotion.
I think that's exactly right. At the turn of the century, emotion was crucial to theories of art. We have formalists saying that art is going to involve significant form, where significant form is formal qualities of work that excite certain emotions. And we have expressive theories saying that art is about transmitting your passions as an artist to the audience. But then that all disappears. And I think the second half of the 20th century has been a flight away from the emotions in our theories of art.
Why do you think that is?
Well, of course, part of it tracks art practice itself. So in the arts, we've seen a move to art that looks increasingly cerebral, conceptual art, even pop art, which is seen as a kind of offshoot of a conceptual movement, minimalism, obviously. The museums have gotten to a point where you couldn't even understand what you're seeing if you didn't read the placard. And I think that intellectualism has affected philosophical theory.
Now, as I understand it, you want to emphasize the importance of emotion in our experience of art. So you're, as it were, running against the vein here.
That's right. I think emotions have always been central to the experience of art. They're central to our interest in art. Why are we motivated to go to museums to look at artworks? They're central to the creation of art. And I think even with these shifts in art practice in the 20th century, we've never left the emotions behind. And if you look at what artists are trying to do and what museum goers are after, I think the emotions remain an essential part of the story.
Could you flesh that out a bit? I mean, what part do the emotions play? I mean, obviously, people are moved by some artworks, but not by all.
If you say what's the difference between looking at art and looking at reality, I think one of the things that demarcates the artistic domain is it's a world of the extraordinary. These are things that are breaks from our ordinary life. So one of the things we look for in art is an encounter with something novel, something special, something new. And there are emotions that are attendant to that kind of stimulus. The extraordinary brings about states of wonder, states of awe, states of marvel. So when we say how marvelous, as Ken Walton has pointed out in looking at an artwork, we're actually revealing something important about the nature of art, that art is a domain of marvel.
And would you say that's also true of our experience of conceptual art?
I think that the flight from emotion was very connected to the idea of the ready-made, because we used to think that art wore its artiness on its sleeves, as it were. You could read off an object that it is a work of art. So the extraordinariness was supposed to be intrinsic and recognizable. We immediately are bowled over by a work of great beauty, for instance. But as artists gave up on beauty and moved to ideas, the thought was that suddenly emotion is irrelevant. But I think the mistake there lies in failing to appreciate that conceptual art is also something extraordinary. In fact, it's an example of what Arthur Danto talks about in the context of pop art as transfiguration of the commonplace. It's taking a familiar object and recontextualizing it in a way that suddenly makes it special again. And I think conceptual art in general is an act of puzzlement. It's a way of creating curiosity, intrigue. It's very much in the tradition of art of the mysterious, art of the obscure. When Edmund Burke talks about terror in art, what he has in mind are these opaque passages of Milton where everything is a bit bewildering. But aren't we bewildered when we see a curious work by Marcel Duchamp?
Yeah, so Marcel Duchamp took real objects, like famously a urinal, put it into an open art exhibition, and this challenged preconceptions about what art is. But one of them was surely that art is aesthetic and art is capable of arousing a particular range of emotions, because he chose something which he thought was deliberately unappealing in terms of its beauty.
There we see another key to understanding why emotion drifted out. The notion of beauty as central to art was a kind of red herring. It led people towards emotions that I think are not exactly right. Of course, much art is beautiful, and there are emotions that arise when we experience beauty. But the pleasures and delights of beauty are only a small part of artistic practice. And I think artistic practice has always been more connected to things like rites and ritual, more connected to mystery, more connected to creating experiences that instill a kind of unease. And when Duchamp disrupts our expectations in the gallery, imagine this occurring at the end of a century that's been preoccupied with the pretty, he's in a way returning to an older notion of art where art is something sacred, art is something magical, art is something that has us in a state of perplexity where we have to give up on prior assumptions of what we can expect.
So you're saying that the emotions experienced in relation to ready-mades are emotions, but it's just, when people say that this is very cerebral, they're just looking at the wrong sorts of emotions because they're expecting something like an overwhelming sense of beauty or some kind of expression of sadness that they associate with that work. And what they should be doing is focusing on a different range of emotions, which is common to a lot of our experience of art.
That's exactly right. And I've actually come more specifically to think that the cardinal emotion, the key to all of this, is the emotion of wonder. And as I began to look at this, I realized that wonder has been part of the story about art since the beginning. We all hear that for the ancients, the key to art was mimesis, was imitation of life. But if you actually read in ancient aesthetics, what they found so striking about imitation is that it induced wonder. People were blown away by an artist's capacity to create something lifelike. And for the medievals, who are creating these wondrous icons, that sense of mystery was also crucial to their practice. In the Renaissance, Vasari starts to write about the aspirations of painters, and he returns to these classical ideas of creating wonderment through imitation. In Baroque, that was taken to extremes with these lavish still lifes, with trompe-l'oeil, with beautiful landscapes. The Romantics, of course, took the landscape to a point of mystery by creating a kind of untidy nature, a threatening space that made us aware of how much we've controlled our environment and that there was this untamed wilderness out there, very centrally involving and evoking wonder. And in the 20th century, I think we've stopped thinking in terms of wonder, maybe because of these associations with these romantic ideals, but that same sense of mystery and puzzlement is in place. And I think another aspect of all of this, which you see throughout the history of art, is a notion of the spiritual, because wonder is also an emotion that arises in religious contexts. And if you think about the history of art coming out of places of worship, moving into the churches, you see it in Islamic mosques, you see it in Indian temples, you see it in the temples of China. It's only in the modern period that art moved away from religion. And we've gotten to a point where even mentioning religious themes in the context of the art world is considered an embarrassment at best. The religious and the art-oriented tend to be totally different populations. But the art-oriented go to museums as if they're churches. They go to pay homage. They treat artistic masters as if they're certain kinds of supernatural agents. The mere touch of a master's hand on the most insignificant work will be viewed with reverence. So I think that religiosity is part of the wonder experience as well.
Something you haven't mentioned as well is the wonder at the artistry of the artist. So my experience of a Leonardo, for instance, isn't just an experience of a represented object or a represented person. It's an awe at the skill with which he applied the pigments.
That's quite right. But I think it, in a way, begins to transcend skill. It gets to a point where we've credited Leonardo with such special gifts that it's almost as if his mere touch confers a kind of majesty. With a psychologist, I've conducted some experiments looking at this phenomenon exactly. So one experiment simply asked people to imagine that the Mona Lisa burned in a fire. All that's left are some ashes. Now you have 5 minutes to visit the Louvre, and in one wing of the Louvre, there's a perfect replica. There are many very, very accurate renditions of the Mona Lisa, and in another wing, you have the ashes. Which would you rather see? And here about 80% say they'd rather look at the ashes. We also had people look at doodles by various artists, including Leonardo. And we picked doodles intentionally for their poor quality, things that were really just scratchings on a page. And we showed people a Leonardo doodle, and we said, how much would you have to be paid in order to give this doodle to a museum collection, say? Would you ever part with it? And we actually couldn't analyze the data because several of our participants wrote in an infinity sign. They've given infinite value to something simply because it's been in contact with the hand of the master.
But isn't that this interesting psychological phenomenon of what some psychologists have called essentialism, that we have a kind of magical thinking where we think that certain sorts of objects become imbued with special powers because they've been in touch with somebody important? So it's a bit like sentimental value. The pen that my grandfather owned can't be replaced by a visual copy, indiscernible copy, because he didn't hold that one.
I think it is essentializing, but I think it's also important to realize that the essentializing explanation is too intellectual, because we do know better than that. We do know that there can't actually be something about this doodle that merely through some transmission of molecules has a magical quality. So I actually think our tendency to engage in magical thinking is further evidence that emotion is fundamental to art. It's only emotion that could lead us to give up on the dictates of reason and treat these objects as if they had that special quality.
Well, one take would be it's just irrational that we ought to prefer the brilliant copy of the Mona Lisa above a pile of ashes.
Of course, the demand for reason in the domain of art is itself begging the very question at issue. If you say, what's the value to art for us? A rationalist view might say it's the information it conveys, something we can learn about the world through art. And I certainly don't want to deny that art can be a source of knowledge. But I think if you ask why art, why does art exist? Why do we invest in art? Why do we spend money on cinema? Why do we buy memberships at museums? Why do we decorate our walls or put on headphones while walking to the office? I think the answer has got to be that there's more than the information. The quality of the experience we get, the emotions that we experience when looking at art and listening to art, are the primary motivator in keeping this institution at work.
Well, let's say you're right about that, and that art is fundamentally tied up with emotion, and particularly the emotion of wonder. Does that unlock any of the difficult problems that have been there in the history of the philosophy of art?
Well, I think it speaks to some of the core questions. Two questions that have been especially important in the last century of analytic aesthetics are the nature of aesthetic experience and the nature of art itself. What is art? Just beginning with aesthetic experience, one of the observations that has been made, for example, by Schopenhauer, is that you can view something in an aesthetic way or a non-aesthetic way. You can look at a tree as a tree, or you can step back and say, let me behold it as art. Let me look at it as an aesthetic object. And what's going on there? And various people like Monroe Beardsley and others have tried to come up with theories of that, often emphasizing things like the balance of complexity and simplicity, or the unified nature of the experience. And by most accounts, these particular theories have failed. They're subject to very widely publicized counterexamples. But I think the emotion account has the greatest initial appeal, because if the aesthetic experience is fundamentally about having a certain kind of an emotion, then all we need to do is identify that emotion and we have a story. Now, of course, art varies greatly. There are many different kinds of art. Every cultural tradition has invented its own artistic styles. So to find an emotion that can hold all of those things under a single umbrella turns out to be a challenge. Not all art is pleasurable. Not all art is inspiring or illuminating or depressing or frightening. But wonder looks like a plausible common denominator. Everything from the Mogul miniature to the most abstruse work of conceptual art or minimalist art or pop art seems to be connected in its capacity to induce these experiences of wonderment. If that's true, then the experience of something as art might be defined as follows. You might say looking at the tree aesthetically is a matter of looking for its capacity for wonder. You might not find it, but when you go to a gallery and see something as art, when you suddenly realize a ready-made is art, what you realize is that you're supposed to assess it in a way that looks towards its potential to induce these feelings in us.
What about bad art then? Because if I look at a particularly bad piece of art, I feel no glimmerings of wonder.
Good. And I don't think it's the glimmering that matters. I think it's the recognition that it's of a kind that's in the business of wonder production. One of the, I think, pitfalls in the search for a theory of aesthetic experience is people think there needs to be something phenomenologically present in every aesthetic experience that unifies them. But instead, if you think about aesthetic experience as a kind of application of aesthetic norms where you're looking to see whether the work succeeds, then we can look at bad art and good art on the same page. Both of them are trying to be successful, and their failures simply reflect the inapplicability of our rules. Successful art is the art that succeeds in producing wonder. So looking at an object, including a bad work of art aesthetically, is looking to see whether it passes our wonder threshold.
So in your model, would the intensity of the feelings of wonder be a marker of the quality of the work of art as work of art?
It's a tough question because there's a danger here. I think we do find certain kinds of art engaged in the practice of spectacle, of trying to create very intense feelings. And the intensity of those feelings is often inversely correlated with our considered judgments about whether the work is good. So we see this in cinema, film that is extremely dramatic or violent, tremendous explosions, creatures from outer space become a kind of wonder show. And those films are less valued than the ones that deal with subtle emotion and nuance of human experience, or even films that are challenging in ways that are difficult for viewers to engage. I think we're going to learn here something from Longinus, who wrote the first tome on the sublime. And what Longinus tells us is that what matters for the sublime is not the impact of the first pass experience. It's the capacity for enduring reward on repeat viewing, on repeat experience. A sublime poem is not the one that's so dramatic that it leaves our jaws on the ground from awe. They're rather the ones that we keep making new discoveries in every time we reread. And likewise with art, it's a capacity for enduring wonder. I think it's there that aesthetic greatness lies.
You've been talking about the way that feelings of wonder are the common denominator amongst the things that we call art, but there are more things that cause wonder than art. So it doesn't really give us an account of what art itself is.
I think in a way that's the cardinal question in modern aesthetics. People have been extremely interested in how art can be defined, or even how it can be recognized, how we know we're in the presence of an artwork, and what marks off this special category. I've suggested that wonder is part of it, but you're quite right to point out it can't be the whole story. Given our capacity to experience wonder in nature, wonder in religious contexts, the wonder of science, all of those things are similar in emotional potential, but we don't view them as art. One key here, I think, is to recall that artworks are, in some sense, artifacts, or more broadly, their creations. I think the term work in artwork is crucial because it reminds us that art is not just something that's given to us in the world. It's something we have to do some toil to bring about. The toil might be toil of invention. The ready-made is not created by the artist. The artist makes the decision or the choice to recontextualize something. And with performance art, of course, it's not an object that exists in space and time. It's an activity or an event. But all of these things are works. All of these things are productions. I think we can use that together with the wonder story to arrive at something like a definition of art, where we can say art is a work that has been created with the aspiration of inducing wonder. Now, that aspiration might not be conscious, so we can put it in a little more indirect formulation by saying artworks are works that are created to be appraised aesthetically, and then we can say, what is aesthetic appraisal? Aesthetic appraisal is appraisal that leads to wonder when successful.
I could imagine a theme park designed with the aspiration of creating a sense of awe and wonder in the people who go around the theme park. Would that make it a work of art?
I think we should be open to that possibility. And in fact, systems of the art that have existed over time have been quite varied from time and place. So our current system that includes things like music, dance, poetry, and painting might look like a strange grab bag, a potpourri. And if we look cross-culturally, I mentioned gardening in our own European past, but in Japan, for instance, you find the tea ceremony or flower arrangement or puppetry as key arts. Should we include the theme park? Should we include the circus? I'm inclined to say that if we let wonder dictate our account of what art is, then it should be treated as an open question which things deserve to be called art.
Jesse Prince, thank you very much.
An absolute pleasure.
For more Philosophy Bites, go to www.philosophybites.com. You can also find details there of Philosophy Bites books and how to support us.